Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
That vaccine millions of people already have in their arms now has the final formal sign-off. So now what? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, D.C., I'm Kimberly Adams in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, August 23rd. Good to have you with us. Today, the Food and Drug Administration finally gave its full approval to the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine for Americans age 16 and older. Up until now, all the vaccines were allowed under emergency use authorizations. Now, this may seem like a technical regulatory thing, but public health officials say it's a really big deal, especially for the growing number of employers considering a vaccine requirement. Marketplace's Matt Levin reports.
Federal courts and the Department of Justice had already told employers, look, if you want to impose a vaccine mandate, go right ahead. Legally, you don't have to wait for full FDA clearance. So then why is today's announcement a big deal?
I think there's some chief executive officers who have really lost patience with unvaccinated employees and will instantly point to this news as a basis for a mandate.
Bob Nichols is a lawyer for the Houston-based firm Bracewell. He's been advising major companies on their vaccine policy. He expects a wave of new employer mandates. And now that the somewhat scary phrase emergency use is gone,
more employees are likely to throw in the towel and agree to vaccination.
Still, a mandate isn't a no-brainer. One reason companies like Walmart have stopped short of requiring a vaccine for everyone? The labor shortage. CEOs have to ask themselves some tough questions, says Kosalee Simon, a health economist at Indiana University.
Is there going to be a lot of turnover or needing to go and hire new workers to fulfill jobs if there are many who don't comply with the vaccine mandate?
Companies may turn to softer penalties, like a monthly surcharge on health insurance. Wade Simons is with the HR consulting firm Mercer.
Employers are looking at sort of that middle step, which is you have the potential to cost us more in health insurance costs because of your unvaccinated status.
Employers may get an assist from the vaccine makers themselves. Full FDA approval means they can start running TV ads for the vaccine, which already has a branded name, Comirnaty. Gotta say, that does not roll off the tongue super well. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Also happening in Washington today, the House of Representatives is back from August recess a bit early this year as Democrats attempt to pass several major pieces of legislation, including the president's big infrastructure agenda, which comes down to two separate but related measures. First, the $1 trillion bipartisan Senate bill focused on infrastructure like railroads and highways. And then there's the budget resolution, which could pave the way for Congress to pass legislation on a party line vote focusing on human infrastructure. Now, we haven't seen the details of that legislation yet, but it would spend an estimated $3.5 trillion on things like expanding Medicare, universal pre-K, and paid family leave. The issue? Timing, says Molly Reynolds, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution.
You have differences of opinion in the House Democratic caucus on kind of which one should go first.
And among the House Democrats, not everyone agrees on the legislation.
One major sticking point for relatively more moderate Democrats is the size of the proposal that the budget resolution would make possible.
Meaning that $3.5 trillion price tag. So it's worth watching this week which passes first, if at all. On Wall Street, they love that vaccine news. We'll have all the details when we do the numbers. Also wrapped up in the infrastructure package are efforts to expand the infrastructure for electric vehicles. But at the moment, many EVs are about to come off the road. General Motors is recalling the Chevy Bolt, one of the more popular electric cars in America, because of a manufacturing defect that's caused its batteries to catch fire at least 10 times. Only 2 or 3% of cars sold in the U.S. are electric, but car manufacturers and the Biden administration have both set targets well beyond that and say electric cars are the future. Marketplace's Marielle Segarra reports.
First, some context. There have been 10 confirmed Chevy Bolt fires over the past 5 years. Disturbing. But Chris Harto at Consumer Reports says
there are over 20 vehicle fires every hour of every day.
That's fires in vehicles overall.
So from that perspective, the Chevy Bolt is certainly no more risky than the vehicle you currently have.
Now, the risk can be different for electric cars versus gas-powered ones. Joseph Schofer, an engineering professor at Northwestern University, says with an internal combustion engine, you're carrying around highly flammable gasoline, which can cause fires while you're driving.
On the other hand, it's much less likely that a car with an internal combustion engine is going to catch fire in the middle of the night in your garage.
That has happened to electric cars while they're charging. GM says that it's working out these issues, repairing the existing Chevy Bolts, and that its new electric car models will have a different battery design. Will the recall hurt electric car sales long term? Sam Fiorani is a VP at Auto Forecast Solutions.
People are just getting comfortable with electric vehicles. So any sort of issue tarnishes the idea of an electric vehicle to the customer.
People will often accept the risks of things they know, but not things that are new to them. But he thinks long term, it will be forgotten, like a lot of the recalls of gas-powered cars. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
Replacing those gas-powered cars with EVs is part of a larger agenda to reduce emissions, including the amount of methane the oil and gas industry pumps into the atmosphere. But in order to reduce it, we need to be able to measure it. And that's not easy. The Environmental Protection Agency's way of calculating methane pollution has been widely criticized for underestimating emissions. So this week, the agency is holding a public workshop ahead of releasing new rules next month. Marketplace's Andy Euler has more.
So there are two ways to measure how much methane the oil and gas industry emits. The first is what researchers call bottom-up. You multiply the number of potentially leaky valves and storage tanks and so on by an estimate of how much each part leaks. That's how the EPA does it. And then there's the top-down method.
Technologies that can be used to estimate methane emissions from oil and gas.
Jeff Rutherford studies methane emissions at Stanford.
And that includes airplane-based sensors, satellite-based sensors, vehicle-based sensors.
That method suggests the oil and gas industry is emitting almost twice as much methane as the EPA says. Arvind Ravikumar at the University of Texas at Austin wrote a paper with Rutherford trying to explain why there's such a disparity.
There are two things that need to be updated.
First, the EPA has been using equipment counts based on industry self-reporting and studies from the 1990s, before fracking. And then
there's a very small number of sites that contribute disproportionately to total methane emissions.
But the EPA simply uses an average, so it undercounts the impact of those methane super spreaders. Now, ideally, the EPA would use both bottom-up and top-down methods, says Robert Kleinberg at Columbia University, and there's room for the private sector to help.
It's a very healthy ecosystem now of technology providers, and so there's no reason why we can't do a good job of finding and fixing our methane problem.
He says helping the EPA measure the problem will ultimately help the oil and gas industry reduce it. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
We know life is busy. If you miss us, we have our podcast available on your podcast platform of choice. During the height of the pandemic, Congress increased the monthly food benefit for SNAP participants. That expansion is set to expire at the end of September, so the Biden administration is making long-term changes to the program. The Department of Agriculture recently approved a plan for a permanent increase to SNAP benefits starting in October. I spoke to Sharon Parrott, president of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, about what those changes mean for low-income families, and I started by asking her what led to the latest benefit update.
What happened in 2018 is that Congress actually directed, on a bipartisan basis, as part of bipartisan legislation, directed the Department of Agriculture to reevaluate the Thrifty Food Plan, which is the basis for the SNAP benefit. And so researchers and nutritionists looked at, well, what does it cost in the United States to feed a family a healthy diet? And their conclusion is that it costs more than we had previously assumed. And so this benefit increase will make it easier for many households to afford to put healthy food on the table.
In response to the Biden administration's latest increase to these benefits, congressional Republicans want to review the USDA's process in all of this. Specifically, they want the Government Accountability Office to see if there really is a connection between an increase in SNAP benefits, like the one that's going to happen, and the consumption of healthier foods. What are they going to find?
So there's a couple things to say. First is, it's really important to understand that USDA undertook this reevaluation at the direction of Congress. In 2018, under a Republican president and with a Republican Congress, Congress passed the Farm Bill and directed USDA to reevaluate the Thrifty Food Plan based on consumption information about what people actually buy, as well as dietary guidance, as well as food prices. We know that when people have more adequate amounts of money, they are better able to buy a healthy diet. We also know that people in the United States of all income levels often fall short of those dietary guidelines. And so we need to have adequate SNAP benefits so people can afford a healthy diet. And all of us, not just low-income people, but all of us need to do a better job of making healthy choices.
And I imagine all of this harms certain low-income groups much more than others.
That's right. We know that food insecurity has really big impacts, negative impacts on children. We know that when kids don't get enough to eat, they don't do as well in school. More broadly, we know that both poverty and food insecurity, the inability to have enough money to buy the food that a household needs, is higher among Black and Latino households. They have lower earnings. They face employment discrimination. They have less access to quality education. And all of that means that their poverty rates are higher and their food insecurity rates are higher. That means that if SNAP is doing an inadequate job of helping people afford a healthy diet, it is impacting communities of color more than white people.
During the pandemic, there was an increase in SNAP benefits, you know, because of the emergency. That was about $28. We have the Biden administration's recent increase as well. Are we on a path to a more sustainable SNAP benefit for low-income families?
Well, this is a real step in the right direction. USDA has reevaluated in a really careful way the cost of a healthy diet. Starting October 1, that will be the basis of SNAP benefits going forward on an ongoing and permanent basis, unlike some of the emergency provisions we've put in place to raise nutrition assistance just during the pandemic and this economic crisis. Those are temporary and will end when the crisis ends. And some of those increases actually will end at the end of September.
Sharon Parrott is president of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up,
this is a large-scale project
trying to give a jolt to one local economy. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 215.6 tenths% to close at 35,335. The Nasdaq rose 227 points, 1.5%, to end at 14,942. And the S&P 500 added 37 points, 0.8%, to finish at 4479. Pfizer shot up 2.4% after its COVID-19 vaccine approval. Its vaccine partner, BioNTech, rallied 9.5%. But a survey out today from data firm IHS Markit showed growth in business activity slowed for a third straight month in August because of the Delta variant, capacity constraints, and supply shortages. Bond prices rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.25%, and you're listening to Marketplace.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate minority leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams. We've still got a bit of summer left, so a couple stories now about the tourism industry. People are flocking to coastal getaways, for example, in Maine, where the influx of visitors hasn't been easy on those working in the state's restaurant industry. Maine Public Radio's Robbie Feinberg has more.
Bartender Haley Wilson pours a few drinks inside the Portland Hunt and Alpine Club, a Scandinavian-themed bar that's a few blocks from the waterfront in Portland, Maine. She says the job is great. It's around $15 an hour plus tips, which is better than most. And Wilson says it's fun to throw a good party.
And that's, you know, what we do every day is tiny individual parties for people. I love the aspect of taking care of people.
But Wilson says she hasn't felt that same love over the past 18 months. Like many restaurants, the Hunt and Alpine Club was forced to shut down last year. And Wilson says since it reopened, she's had to take on new responsibilities, like acting as a makeshift bouncer and enforcing mask mandates at the door.
Like, we would have to stand in the doorway and kind of use our bodies to block people from coming in who aren't wearing masks, and repeating the same thing over and over and getting eye rolls or frustration or, you know, aggression from it, it takes a toll on someone.
Wilson says the pushback has been way worse over the past few weeks. With COVID-19 cases rising, the bar instituted a new rule requiring customers to be vaccinated if they want to eat indoors. While many have been understanding, Wilson says others have fought back.
And it kind of breaks my heart a little bit to think about if I was, you know, if I wasn't here, if I wasn't making the livable wage that I am with benefits and tips on top, I would probably be considering leaving the industry for something more stable.
The pandemic has forced many restaurant workers to face that same dilemma, as business closures and changing health protocols have put additional pressures on workers. Diego Bufquin, a professor of hospitality management at the University of Central Florida, says the pandemic seriously impacted many restaurant staff. A study from Bufquin and his colleagues found that restaurant workers who stayed on the job last year had more stress and used more alcohol and drugs than those who were furloughed. Some look to leave the industry. Bufquin isn't surprised that when many restaurants reopened this year, workers were tough to find.
And so for hospitality companies to try to attract these folks back to their sector, they must, of course, offer a variety of perks to attract those employees. So that's the whole phenomenon that we're seeing right now.
The issue is a long time coming. Daryl Deegan says many workers have been forced to deal with low wages and benefits for years. His company, Maine Cater, works to recruit staff members for restaurants in northern New England. He now has a waiting list of more than 100 clients, caterers and restaurants in Maine and New Hampshire who need staff.
And the shoe is now on the other foot.
You know, now it's the job seekers that have all the power. They're the ones that can dictate, you know, what they're looking for in terms of rates of pay, benefit packages.
Deegan says some companies increased wages, added perks like paid time off, and changed hours so staff aren't working such long shifts. But some workers say they'd like to see more, such as increasing the federal minimum wage and changing the lower so-called tipped wage so that their pay is more reliable. And Matt Lewis, who heads Maine's hospitality trade group, is asking for a bit of patience from customers as stretched restaurants and workers attempt to manage this summer's deluge of tourists.
We still want people to come to Maine. We still want people to have a good time, but you may have to wait a little bit longer to check in or go to an attraction or have a dinner at your favorite restaurant.
Lewis says some restaurants are looking at new ways to meet workers' needs, including potentially helping them find housing. But in the meantime, the industry still expects the labor shortage to continue for years to come. In Portland, Maine, I'm Robbie Feinberg for Marketplace.
Looking at the global tourism industry, India's Taj Mahal, America's Statue of Liberty, Greece's Acropolis all have one thing in common: a World Heritage designation. UNESCO, the UN's cultural body, does the designating, and it can translate into more tourism revenue, which can incentivize preservation of historic sites. The English city of Liverpool had that World Heritage designation for 17 years, but not anymore. The BBC's Victoria Craig reports.
Where the River Mersey laps the shore, an economic evolution has taken place over centuries. As a pioneer in dock technology and construction in the 1700s, Liverpool's Royal Albert Dock rose to prominence for its role in transatlantic sea trade. By the next century, nearly half of global trade passed through these waters. But
in the 70s, when international trade changed, technology changed, the port, in effect, collapsed. And with that, a big chunk of the city's economy. The city collapsed economically, socially, politically, physically.
That's Michael Parkinson from the University of Liverpool. He's a public policy professor who also serves on the city's World Heritage Task Force, and he's authored several books on the rise and fall of Liverpool's economy. He explains in the decades since a drastic economic decline, the city has battled back.
In the 35 years since then, it's had a fantastic renaissance, funded by European money, helped by national government, supported by some good local leaders.
Indeed, nearly $1 billion has been spent regenerating the so-called maritime mercantile city. And in 2004, UNESCO gave a World Heritage designation to six sites over 300 acres that included piers, docklands, warehouses, produce exchanges, and civic buildings. But recent plans to rejuvenate the northern part of the docklands drew scrutiny from UNESCO, and last month it revoked the coveted status. Here's Rika Viragos, a specialist at the World Heritage Center, who helped prepare information used to make the final decision about Liverpool's status.
In 2012, the World Heritage Committee considered that the proposal for a huge project that was called the Liverpool Waters Project is threatening the property.
Years after consultations with government officials took place, but plans for the nearly $7 billion project to include new offices, hotels, cruise liner and ferry terminals have gone ahead. The biggest point of contention for UNESCO was a nearly $700 million proposal to build a new soccer stadium for Everton Football Club at Bramley Moor Dock.
This is a large-scale project that is not tailored to the characteristic of the values in the site.
Virago says delisting the site is a loss for the international community, and Liverpool's mayor, Joanne Anderson, agrees. But she says the city can't exist in a time warp.
We have an area that is, you know, one of the poorest areas in the country, and so the football stadium is a massive investment that we can't afford to lose to tackle poverty in that area. We've got to still value our heritage. We've got to protect our future as a city, but also make sure that we grow economically as well.
The development at Bramley Moore Dock, including the stadium, is expected to bring a more than $1 billion boost to the local economy. For the people running the city, the decision about moving ahead with this development or retaining the World Heritage designation came down to how Liverpool should value the economic well-being of its people. Here's Professor Parkinson again.
The city never really got any added economic value of having the status. It didn't get more investment, it didn't get more tourists. North Liverpool, which was the start of the city, hasn't had its fair share. And that's what this row with UNESCO is really all about. It's about what's the economic future of the city and who decides it for whom.
UNESCO says the city can renominate a former part of the World Heritage Site for recognition if it believes the area still has outstanding universal value. For now, though, the mayor and many in the community have decided to let it be as they focus on building an economically vibrant city that remains true to its historic past. In Liverpool, I'm the BBC's Victoria Craig for Marketplace. This final note on the way out today. Since Kai is away, I'll do this one for him. Starbucks is ready for fall. The company announced today its cloyingly sweet pumpkin spice products are returning starting tomorrow. This launch keeps creeping earlier and earlier. Kind of like the holiday shopping season. Enjoy, I guess. For your moment of economic context today, like Matt was saying at the top of the show, the formal FDA approval of the Pfizer vaccine opens the door for even more companies and organizations to mandate vaccines for their employees. Dozens of big companies already have them in place, with more joining the list daily, and at least three federal agencies have one so far: the Department of Defense, Veterans Affairs, and Health and Human Services. Our daily production team includes Anais Amin, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Minju Park. I'm Kimberly Adams. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.